if you get a lead on your first day, you are 22% more likely to sell your property.
Really?
And that's on average, you will get an offer within just over 30 days. Now, if you get your first lead between 2 and 4 weeks, that time period until you get that offer is almost 3 months.
Welcome to the Navigating Podcast, where we talk about business, passions, entrepreneurship, and finding balance between work and life. This week, we have Rory Hook, CFO of Rightmove. Today, he provides us with incredible data and insights into the market today and the future. I hope you enjoy.
And another way to flip it is we then look at saying, okay, how many reduce their price? And it's like, if you get a lead on your first day, then we see less than 20% of those properties have to reduce their price in order to get over the line. Whereas if you get a lead between 2 and 4 weeks, it's over 50% of properties have to reduce their price. Uh-huh. So it just shows you the importance of pricing right on the first day and what a huge impact that has, even in that small period where I'm sure, you know, probably won't get a lead for a lot longer than that. But just even in the difference between that first day and say 2 weeks,
crazy,
has that marked impression. And that's why it's always like you have to price right and also be prepared if you haven't priced right to move the price. Otherwise your house will get stale. People get bored of it. It just sits there. So
I love all the data you've got.
So do we.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be really fun to play around with it. I mean, I don't think we're big enough to benefit from. So as we get bigger, I keep finding out that all the big boys have got all of this data stuff that they analyze all the time. So I've started getting a little bit of it and chatting with people that provide it. And I just don't think we're quite big enough.
No, and I agree with you, which is why I think have a play around, because we'll be interested in just general feedback from a partner, especially something that's under the radar. Going forward, if you're like, something's happening, you're like, am I the only one in here, right? Then again, just give me a call and we can run some data and be like this.
As we've got bigger, and I think particularly as we cover different areas, we now have, and it's still small amounts of data, but you know, our Chelsea over 10 million can be really quiet. And they're sitting there like, what's going on?
Yeah.
But, you know, 3 million up in Notting Hill is flying. So we're like, no, people are there. It's,
well, what's interesting, right, is actually Tony might be able to, and one of the people in your office would know it, is you do your patches. So what you do is you'll define who your competitors are within your patch. Now, because we've got 80%, over 80% of all consumers who are on a portal are on Rightmove. So it's a huge, huge lead on any of the competitors. We generally think, although no one discloses a number of leads, you can sit there and say it's probably not too far off that. Because of that, therefore, we can see all the leads that are being sent in your patch. And what account manager should be able to do is sit there and saying, this is your leads, and actually in your place, you're not doing too badly because we can see all the leads that are going elsewhere and it's the same for all of you. Or might be like, you're falling behind in terms of your market share. And they, of course, can have that ability to sit with you guys and say, this is what we can see amongst your competitors who you've classified and what they're doing.
It's pretty obvious to figure. I mean, it's usually price.
We see all of that. It could be price. On the leads, but it, you know, sometimes it can be on, you know, marketing or just a type of listing. So most of the time you look at price, but I think there are some parameters. And I think where we always look at it is for you, for an agent, there's basically three things we always think about it. It'd be interesting if you think we've missed one, but it's like the first part is you want to get, you know, you want to get a valuation opportunity. You want to come out and be able to value someone's house. So that's the first bit. Then you want to win that. You want to win the instruction. And once you win the instruction, you want to sell the property. And effectively, the way that we always look at it is if a business isn't doing great against competitors, it's because of one of those three things. It's not often all three of them. It's like, you're fine, you're getting invited out loads, but you're always losing. Why is that? Or like, you're winning them, but you're not selling the properties. You need to help shift that, which might be pricing, it might be some marketing as well. And it's generally in those buckets of three. And that's what the data account should be able to bring and say, like, we've got such a marketing position, we can see amongst that those funnel where you're performing against all three of them against your competitor base. And what's really interesting on multi-agents is multi-branches, where it might completely differ between different branches as well, because it's often not a company-wide thing. It's very branch-specific. And one of the other things I love is when a buyer sends a lead, more often than not, we ask them, you know, do you have to sell your property? And loads of people tick it. They don't have to, but a load of people do it. It's amazing how different some agents are at seeing that as an opportunity to try and win that vendor.
Yeah.
And most people just walk past it. Like, this person is literally telling you they've got to sell their property. And we show where they end up selling their property. So we can actually show, this is how many came to you. but tick that box and where they ended up. And by the way, you captured 10%, but that so-and-so captured all of them. And you then show them against the branches. And I know we've had some, multi-branches be like, that is, you know, unbelievable, amazing, but also like how they can use that to part the branch. Often the branches
you can sit different branches are, you know, one's 50%, one's 5%.
All different ranges.
Wow.
Like that. And you can say, look, this branch number one's been great. Out of them, they converted 75%. These guys only convert 10%. And usually something as simple as they just haven't clocked it and asked the question, have you chosen an agent to sell your property? Is it on the market or are you going to? You know what I mean? So, and it's just those small things. So that's where the data's helpful, but it's also helpful because being the largest, we can have that ability to do that. And you know, it's funny, I'm the same my property at the moment, we've had two people come along and said, love the house, would love to make an offer, but haven't sold my property. You're like, oh, well, that's not much help. But amazingly, again, that's one where you're like, you know,
why hasn't the agent captured that?
Oh, go and help them sell the property. By the way, I know someone at Rhymey if we can help.
So you have just, you have, I mean, we've spoken a lot about it already, but you've got all the data. And what do you see? I mean, we're such a niche little player and we have a little bit of data in our area, but you're seeing the whole market. I mean, we had a drink a few weeks ago. I was just amazed at how much information you have, and you've already touched on it, but what are you seeing right now?
Well, you know, I mean, take a step back. It's interesting with the property market because what's going on now, I think, is people often feel that the UK will all move together, as in whatever happens in the whole UK, what's happening in London is happening in Wales or Scotland. And that's often not the case. Actually, there's huge variances between all of the regions. And sometimes they're really obvious factors. And sometimes it's a little bit surprising. But at the moment, what we're seeing is, you know, the year started off really well, just nationally. I think everyone came out of two really challenging years in terms of high mortgage rates, high interest rates, pretty gloomy uncertainty, and government changes. And there was a little bit of kind of hope going into the new year, and interest rates crucially started falling, and therefore mortgage rates started falling. And so the whole market started coming alive kind of in January and February. We saw that cross region. So we saw double digit growth in demand, people sending leads to try and buy a property, people new listings, so people putting their house on for sale. And then
you're comparing that to the year before?
Same time year before. And then in April, a couple of things happened. We started seeing it to drop, and most markedly in London. And what we saw is the other regions also come down a little bit. And so that made us think, okay, it's not specifically a London challenge that. And the first thing was, what's Trump's tariffs? Because of course, that all blew up. And we thought, but then we looked at the top end of the market, because of course, we can split them between regions to values, any kind of way you can slice the dice. And it wasn't the top end of the market that was actually impacted as much as the bottom end or the medium market. So that made me think, well, that's probably where I would have thought Trump's tariffs would have had an effect. And so then it was like, actually, what we saw was it's just as much the timing of Easter. Because people are like, you know what, I'm going on holiday or I've got family, I'm not thinking about moving property. And actually really hot weather. So like a day like today when it's boiling hot, no one's sitting there actually browsing Rightmove or looking at properties. They're out enjoying themselves in a park.
And we were having a beer at this point and we were both saying, God, yeah, it's gone quiet. And so whenever we see something in the news, we're like, oh, people are going to read this. And it's not today, it's 6 months out of date. So Land Registry, for anyone that doesn't know, produces their information 6 months late. Whereas you're seeing this stuff on the daily. So we were having a drink and you could feel exactly what I was feeling. And I think both of us felt, is it Trump's tariff or is it Easter? And then when I spoke to you last week, you were like, oh no, it was the sun.
Yeah, it was the sun and a bit of timing of Easter. And that's the thing, and we see every single day, and we can see all the price movements, like literally every single day and how many leads, and we monitor that literally on a daily basis.
When you say price movements, that's
asking prices coming down. And so we can, or going up, and we can see the prices and within the regions, and we have amazing dashboards and people pore over that. And really what we're trying to do is also understand the health of the agents, particularly regions. So at the moment, for instance, in Wales, as of this week, so compared to last year, demand, people sending leads, is up 7%. Wales having a great time. Loads of people are sending leads to look at properties and move around. Whereas in London, it's down 4%. Within the top end of the market in prime London, where we are at the moment, and across the whole of London, it's down 2%. So anything over 2 million, and in, you know, kind of Kensington area, which is specifically around central London and Soho and stuff, and that area down 4%, within the whole of London, if I take over, it's still down 1%. But actually, if I then take outside of London and exclude London, then at the moment, demand, people sending leads, is about 4% up in May. So we saw a big decrease in April, and then it's come back up in May. People are resending leads. And people who have swapped contracts, sales agreed, that SSTCs, you know, that is back up almost 10% at a national level. As I mentioned, in central London, prime London, it's down over 40% in this.
So hold on. So nationally, it's up 10%.
Yeah.
And prime central London, over 2 million.
Over 2 million.
It's down 40.
40% year on year in May.
Agreed.
Sales agreed.
For this month.
Yeah. And so what we're seeing is that's really because April was a bad month generally, and therefore not much demand coming. I'll talk about listings as people putting their property on for a second. And then that takes time to make a sales agreed. And so what we're seeing is May is the overhang from a poorer in April. I mean, it's still down. The demand is still down 4% in central London and 2% in the whole of London. So, your sales agreed is still probably going to be a bit sluggish the next kind of couple of months. The good thing outside of London is that demand has come back up in May, and therefore we should see, further sales agreed. What the interesting part I mentioned in your listings is people are still putting their house on the market. So although there's a bit of hesitancy in terms of demand being sent, particularly in London, there's more stock than we've ever had for 10 years. So we have the highest amount of resale stock across the country. And so there's a huge amount of choice. And actually what that shows is people are really confident and want to put the house on and want to move. And why shouldn't they when interest rates come back off a real high for 2 years? But you still see a bit of hesitancy in that demand side, people sending the lead. And there'll be even continue to be as prices are where they're at. It's a buyer's market at the moment. We haven't got as many demand and you've got more listings and more choice. You've got a slight imbalance at the moment between kind of the sellers and buyers. And therefore, we have seen a little bit of a price reduction in May, not just in London, but also nationally. And I think outside of London, that price reduction will correct itself. But I think London may have continued pressure on that until that imbalance sorts itself out.
We find it's the timing of Easter. So for us, and I'm sure you must see it well. It'd be interesting if you see this, but we're a very seasonal market. COVID was chaos with data analyzing. It was all over the place. But we've got back to more of a seasonal kind of. It's quieter during holidays and then it picks back up when kids go back to school. And last year, I mean, we were comparing month on month versus last year, but Easter was a completely different month last year. So comparing it to the year before was tricky. And I think this year it was late.
Yeah.
And again, for us, usually this is one of our best windows between sort of April and July.
Yeah.
But it's a shorter period this year. And May is a nightmare because you've got two bank holidays and a half term.
Yeah.
There's still ambition to sell now, which is
great, right? And we want that stock because ultimately, hopefully with price reduction and a little bit of consumer confidence, that will then provide a pipeline. And look, it's great if you're a buyer because you've got more kind of stock and choice than you've ever had. But I don't think it walks past the fact that, UK, particularly in London, there's been some real headwinds in terms of, higher tax, regulation, and just consumer confidence has been knocked. And ultimately, there's been a fair bit of that in the news. And I think that's definitely true amongst hot weather and Easter's and stuff like that. Just generally speaking, I think some of those green shoots were knocked out in the last couple of months. And, there are people just feeling more hesitant to make a large acquisition in this kind of market. And I think we're, very hopeful that the right environment is still there for us to come out of it. But, we can't underestimate, I think, some of those just general macro. And that's the thing, right? It's actually the property market can be a little bit like an oil tanker, and it can take quite a while for it to change direction up or down. And often it's more the perception of something rather than reality that can ultimately do that. There are interesting shocks or where things have happened so quickly that we've seen. And that's sometimes the really cool stuff in terms of some of the data that we see, not always for the property market or for our partners, but a great example was Brexit, and the vote of Brexit happened. And literally overnight, we went from kind of double digit demands, so lots of leads going around, to it falling 10% literally in the week after. And then it fell 11% the month after. So we went from, high double, decent teen digit kind of growth and people looking for properties down to that 10, 11%. In London, it was down 30% in that week post-Brexit vote saying we're going to leave. And what was interesting is the 10%, although it was a national average, we saw huge regional differences where those that had supported the Brexit vote, their demand actually went up. Now, so we saw these big regional differences.
And it was confidence.
It was confidence. And, you know, some of them saw that as a great opportunity. And so therefore that property market in those areas charged on, was in, you know, other areas, particularly southeastern London, who had been very, you know, very much voting against Brexit. That market completely retreated. And so I guess that's why we're always cautious, because when we see our partners and we're talking to them, there's a lot of differences, A, where they might be in the country and how that might be react to certain things.
Yeah.
And we would love to see a lot more transactions. And, you know, I think on average, someone moves house just over 8 years, you know. And but I think, you know, there's a lot more that could happen in terms of encouraging downsizing, encouraging, you know, first-time buyers to come up onto the property market. It's incredibly difficult, with especially the rental market. But it's being challenging as it is. But I think, you know, the UK market and agents, that's what's remarkable as how consistent the number of agents in the UK has stayed over that period. And many of them have moved into lettings as a source of kind of regular income in order to come through the highs and lows of the property market. The challenge with lettings is it's incredibly difficult for someone at the moment to rent a property because there is so much demand and so little supply. And so I think, you know, there's a real imbalance there at the moment. And, you know, that you know, we always think resale has its challenges. I think the lettings market in particular has seen some really challenging times.
Before we jump into lettings, so I'd love to ask you more on that. Do you spoke a little bit about first-time buyers. And I know, I think that's one of your tick boxes when you're registering for an inquiry.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen over the last 10 years a huge shift in popularity of different assets. So as people have, I mean, we're quite a discretionary market. We've got quite a lot of pied-à-terre owners. We've seen a lot of people change. You know, there was a huge high of apartment living. Then it, you know, that changed, and there was huge house demand. COVID saw a complete, COVID was a, you know, there was a lot of outside living required, but there was also a sort of generational shift where, and I mean, this is very specific for our market, but there were some very smart people that lived here who had a lot of staff, and you'd have a drawing room and it would be very smart. And a lot of wealthy people nowadays want open plan, you know, it's a bit like this, open plan living room straight onto the garden, cooking themselves. And so we've seen so many changes in the demands. And actually that's really, it's really transformed. You know, there's a certain amount of buyers in a market in our market, and they're buying in one area or another area or a different type of architecture. And can you draw down on, I mean, you speak about driving more transactions in first time buyers and downsizers. And I mean, right now we're seeing that those needs-based buyers are a really important part of our market. And there's quite a lot of downsizers and first time buyers. And do you ever consult with the government? Like, do they ask you? Is it? Do you think there's a lot of it's tax? What are the things that could drive?
Yeah, we don't. We do get asked by the government, and we try and engage as much as possible. And we try to do as even more of it in the last few years, because I think we really see ourselves as, you know, being able to play a part in that and really try and be a voice for, you know, the agent community, but also kind of buyers. And so we've been a lot more active in that on recently. I think if I come to two things, when we say the first bit is, do we, what help could first-time buyers, but only buyers have? I think there's at the moment, as I say, it's probably the hardest it's ever been in terms of, you know, mortgages versus kind of asset prices to your kind of income levels. And, you know, generally renting being so expensive and that yield having gone up so much means that, you know, you're having to spend even more money while you're trying to save up. So I think, you know, I'm not jealous of a first-time buyer now compared to 10, you know, 15 years ago.
Has it really changed that much in 10 years, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's just got asset prices, as I said, that on average have gone up 3-4%, in some regions even higher than that. And then on top of that, I think, you know, people's income necessarily haven't risen in line with those kind of asset rises. So I think it's just, you know, harder. Ultimately, I think there just needs to be more stock on the market, and therefore that will help choice for those first time buyers. And a lot of that will probably come from the new build sector rather than necessarily on the resale.
And do you think more stock, I mean, again, with thinking about what the market's going to do, I mean, if there's more stock and less demand, does that mean that prices are corrected and that also helps?
I think naturally, funny, prices always kind of sort themselves out with that hinge demand. I think really for first time buyers, what they are doing, whether you agree with it or not, in terms of the amount of building, they're trying to, you know, basically sort out the issue of there's just not enough supply, rather than the previous governments have said, we'll give you a big help up onto the ladder, and therefore they've pumped the demand by effectively giving them, you know, cheaper options of leveraging and loans and stuff. And that doesn't sort out the problem that there just isn't enough homes in the UK.
Pushed prices up again and made it more difficult for the next generation.
Prices like that. So, you know, I think
building is really
building
important.
Building is key. But at the moment, new homes developers haven't been building. Since the trust budget happened, we've seen a big, big cutback in 2023 as demand came down. But since demand's come back up, new homes builders have struggled to pick that building up. So new homes at the moment advertised on Rightmove is at the lowest it's been in 10 years as a proportion of resale properties.
Wow. So we've got the highest amount of resale and lowest amount of new homes.
And that's making it harder for the new homes builders because they're competing against resale properties, which might be in a better location, might be bigger. So having to fight even harder for that first-time buyer community. So there's a lot of headwinds on that, and it's a really tricky problem. And as I say, I think it's a hard one for the government to kind of sort. It's not an easy one. And there's a lot of speak, but we haven't seen enough action at the moment.
And I mean, this might be a good way to segue into lettings, but how about new build for rent, build to rent?
Yeah, so build to rent's a really fascinating place where we have seen big, big growth, and we expect to see that. And for those that don't know, what we mean by build to rent is kind of large institutionalized businesses that are building very large developments who are then renting them out. So say a very nice big apartment block in London, and often they'll be really nice in terms of concierges, cinemas, gyms, etc. And it's a very US type of model. It's very, very popular in the US, and we've seen a huge growth of that in the UK. Now, I think the government support that because it's much easier to regulate. It's much easier from an ESG perspective, for instance, to make sure that, you know, all of their energy efficiency is, you know, is done properly compared to trying to regulate thousands of buy-to-let landlords. And so we see a real kind of like push on that. And as I say, we've seen a big, big growth of that. And it's attractive because these institutionalized investors can get a very kind of stable yield. So we've seen a big push of buy-to-let landlords leaving the market. So last year, around 25% of all new properties coming to market in the first half of 24 was buy-to-let landlords leaving. That has actually slowed down, but we did see a bit of an exodus from
that. You can track that from you had their property on the market for rent and now you see it.
And we can see that, whether they provide that in information or whether we have that data, so we can kind of track that. And I think that's been like well documented, you know, as a buy-to-let landlord, you know, it's definitely far less attractive through many of reasons. But the push for that rental operators build to rent, we've really seen that. And we definitely see that being a larger proportion of the lettings market going forward. But before I go on, one of the other things you're touching on is, well, first time lines, do we see kind of changes in habits and think that? And one of the things that we do see is which photos people lead with and which photos people are attracted to. And what used to be pre-COVID was it's all about the kitchen. Everyone wants the kind of kitchen shot. That's the kind of one that a lot of people would go to. What does it look like? And then post-COVID, we saw a real growing importance of the outdoor space, the garden, the balcony. What did that look like? And you can plot that basically by how many lead with that photo. And we could really see that dynamic change post-COVID as it was a real push for outdoor space. And then funnily enough, I can't remember exactly, it was about 2022, 23, it started coming back to the kitchen. And so it is interesting about those ones that, you know, we definitely give advice to in terms of our partners about, look, these are the things that we expect consumers are really, really keen on seeing, and, you know, which photos they are and the number of photos. We also can see a big drop off if there's too many. But also which ones are engaging with. So there's really some really cool stuff like that. And also switching up. I mean, it sounds a simple thing, but switching up the photos and making it seem a little bit new as well.
How do you analyze photos? I mean, do you have something that reads?
Click through rates, the amount of activity that we see on people engaging with those photos, whether it's on the app and on the webpage.
So much data that I'm fascinated to know about how we can use this to our advantage to... Yeah, we'd have to have a really clear idea of which data do we need to help drive and improve results.
And I think sometimes for us, or I guess our frustration is, it's not just about giving our partners, estate agents, that information. Often what you really want is the consumer to have that information and try and get past those preconceptions. So it's a bit like I was chatting to you at the beginning of, like, what frustrates us is, how do you pick a partner, like, as an estate agent? And the one thing that makes us pull a hair out is when someone says, oh, they're all kind of alike. And you're like, well, they're all different. So if you think they're alike, ask them, why are they different from the competitors? And you'll all, I'm sure, have your reasons of, I'm different from A, B, and C because of X, Y, and Z. And at least you can judge them. But really what they then go to is, oh, I picked them because they valued the house at the highest, or they were the lowest price. And you're like, the lowest price, all right, is not going to give you the best service. This is your biggest asset. Would you pick the cheapest person to advise you in a big legal case or for an accountancy scan or whatever? No, you're going to pick the best person and you're going to make sure you pay them. And this person is going to sell your house. Don't go necessarily for the cheapest. And the second bit is, oh, they valued the property at the highest, so therefore I went for them. You're like, if they're not prepared to give you bad news or something that you might be against, then again, your question is this the right partner for you? But also saying that stat, which is, you know, on the leads, if you can get a property at the right price and you can get an activity very strong in the first week or 2 weeks, you're so much more likely to sell your property and not to go stale. And so therefore, you really need to get that advice and that price right, even if that is lower than your expectations. And actually, you know better than anyone, is if you can drum up a bit of activity and competition, you know, that's what will really drive a high price in a property.
And I think you gave some stats before we started filming, but it was if you get an inquiry on the first day.
Yeah. So if you get an inquiry on your first day, you're 22% more likely to sell your property, and that is on average you will get an offer within just over 30 days. Whereas if you get your first lead in the 2 to 4 week period, your offer is extended to almost 3 months later. And then the other way of painting a picture is, okay, what we looked at is those that got a lead on their first day, less than 20% ended up having to reduce the price to sell their property. Was in those that got a lead in that 2 to 4 week period, 50% of them had to reduce the price. So it's a false economy coming in at a higher price. Not only is it going to take you a lot longer to finally get an offer, but you're far more likely to actually have to cut the price. Probably to below where, you know, the other valuation is. So setting the price is absolutely critical. And I think for us, it's sometimes the education on the consumer, which is you got these local experts, you know, pick someone who's able to challenge you and really give you that advice. And then I think sometimes the frustration I have here is speaking to people and, you know, how do they pick an agent and asking them, which I often do. It's like those stories being like, no, you want a real sparring partner and advisor in that, because ultimately that's what's going to get you the best outcome at the end of it.
Well, it's great to have data to put towards all of this, because we obviously feel all of this all the time. And particularly right now in our market. And if we are ever so slightly wrong on the price, it's a real disaster.
And it's interesting because we often get asked that by investment advisors saying, you have all the data, you can price right really, really well. It's like, you know what, on a street in London, we have probably at some stage over our 25 years of being a company, every one of those houses has been on and we can see how that's moved and we have an amazing array of data to give a valuation. But actually, we don't know the niches of, like, what does that kitchen look like? What does that look like? So we have an amazing way of guiding our partners, and we often give them a kind of guide price, but we'll never try and do the valuation for them, because that expertise, that final little touch, whether that's just to slightly increase the price we might have guided to or lower it, is the most important part. And so we've always steered away with all the reports that you can get or run or the market say, look, we'll try and give a range. Or, you know, a guide price to say this is it, because it's that final bit that we recognize you can only really do if you're an agent and you know that your whole area inside and back to front.
Interesting.
And that's one of the cool things I mentioned, I think, when we asked for each other is, you know, we do allow consumers, so those browsing on Rightmove, to track their own property. But we give a range for that reason, that we don't want to be like, you know, here is your valuation, right? Because that's going to butt heads against an agent. And we firmly believe that an agent, when they come to value it, will have a better idea. But we give them a range. And that tracker property has only come out relatively recently, and it's taking off, and loads of people wanting to get updates on how their property price changes. But what was really cool is that we saw that on average it's about two people, you know, they're tracking two properties. And I don't know for sure, but I reckon that, you know, is it their in-laws that they're basically tracking? I mean, maybe with kind of inheritance tax, and we're trying to, they're probably trying to track three or four properties, but on average people are tracking two. So it's either their neighbors that are having a look at, or certainly family members, but it's an amazingly cool tool. But I think that was with the data is, you know, very consciously, how do you always got to give it a bit of a caveat. And that, especially on valuations on property, I think they're incredibly sensitive to local markets. And that's where I think agents are always great at that final bit of delivering that. And being flexible and pragmatic as well, you know, and particularly in this current market, I think that's crucial.
Yeah. How, I think one of the things I found interesting when we last spoke was, so you've got amazing oversight over the whole UK market, but you're also a listed business and reporting to the markets. And so you're looking at competitors and other markets and how it works. You know, we're a niche upon a niche upon a niche in our little part of London. But in terms of, you know, agents and marketing, what are other people doing all over the world? I mean, I know our fees are particularly low compared to everyone else, but in terms of, fees, marketing, you know, how are they doing it?
Yeah. And, yeah, I think it's a misconception from a lot of people that property markets are very similar, you know, in Europe. They're incredibly different. And the first thing to say is there's pretty much a right move in every country of the world. Because often people say, oh, why, you know, why wouldn't you go and do what you're doing in the other country? Like, well, because there's a big right move in all of those locations. And but they're all serving a very different type of market. So for instance, in Germany, it's a much more rental driven market. Far more rentals per annum happen than the UK, and many people there rent before they buy. And they rent for a very long time, and some will rent forever. So it's a very rental focused type of market. Whereas in somewhere like Sweden or in Australia, it's what we call a vendor paid market, where the consumer, when they're selling their house, will actually pay the portal direct the marketing fee. So you pay a proportion of marketing fees direct to a kind of portal, and then the agent will basically do all, you know, other parts outside of the marketing, and they might make recommendations for what they think that time should be. But it's a direct kind of vendor monetization there. And, you know, across Europe, you have all of these slight differences, and it's also geared towards how that market behaves and also the regulation. So Germany, for instance, you know, they will monetize to the tenant, whereas in the tenant fee ban in the UK, kind of stopped that from 2019, whereas in yourselves, you couldn't charge something like a reference to a tenant direct. You know, that has to come from the landlord. And so there's very differences, and sometimes they're subtle and sometimes they're market. One thing that does stand out, though, is that the average percentage that a vendor pays a UK agent is far lower than any of the regions across the world. Only in Norway is there less money by a consumer given to an agent. We have not just the lowest, you know, that second lowest in the world, but it's up to like 2 to 5 times less than what you would expect as a vendor or in the UK to pay if you were in Australia or Germany or Sweden. So I think it's quite funny because agents can get quite a bad rep, but actually we don't know, as a consumer, you're selling your house, you get an unbelievable deal. And again, when I come back to it, if that's your biggest asset, I think it's always interesting when people kind of moan about what they've paid an agent. You're like, in any part of the world, you're paying far, far more. And actually, it's an overall percentage of your asset, probably. Why not? And I think, again, it comes back to that price point. Don't underpay. It's kind of going to cost you in the long term.
And why do you think that is?
So I think a couple of things. One of them will be regulation. In the UK, there isn't a regulation. So you can leave school at 16, get a bank loan or get an IOU from mum or dad and set up your own agency. Whereas in, for instance, if you're a realtor in the US or in Australia, you can be spending anywhere between 3 and 5 years having to earn your qualifications. And therefore, I think, you know, that, and of course, probably drives, well, I'm going to expect a bit of return at the end of it. So I think it's to do with part of that. And I think, you know, that's where, unfortunately, you do get some, you know, some bad agents and you get some really good agents in the UK, but there can be that kind of discrepancy. And the UK government is always kind of, you know, steered away from you know, more regulation in the market. I think there's some bodies that would encourage it, and us for one, and or even in terms of qualifications. So I think that, you know, won't help some of that commission levels.
So I started about 17, 18 years ago, and one of my brothers started with us about 10 years ago. And I remember it was newspapers and local magazine drops. So there still are magazines that advertisements get put in, and then they get dropped for free around all of the houses. And that was everything. That was like a big portion of our month spent planning what was going in, and lead times and cost. And I mean, you took it for granted, the cost. And all of the inquiries were from that. We'd be waiting, and it would be, oh, I've just seen you in this magazine, or I've just seen you in this newspaper. And I remember Rightmove, for my first 7 years, it was all magazines. And I remember some of the lower value properties started coming in a little bit through the portals, and we were like, oh, this is interesting, but you know, it's never gonna be the higher value properties. And my brother came in year one, year two, we put a property at 25 million on Rightmove. And I said to him, I was like, look, nothing's gonna come through Rightmove. It's all gonna be this advert that comes out. Waiting 6 weeks for the advert to come out. And day one, five people call up about this 25 million pound house. And we have four of them bidding against each other immediately. And it's exchanged before the magazines come out. Yeah. I just couldn't get my head around it. So great for us as agents, but also all of those people from different parts of the world. So for our market, for people to be able to see it in Russia and the US and Spain, and it's extraordinary. And I've just finished a 6 week course on AI at Oxford Business School. And it's, so he talks to our clients about Instagram and LinkedIn and different stuff that we're doing on social media. And I think it's quite a foreign world, but it's sort of getting to grips with it. But AI.
And how do you think following that course, you think you'll leverage it, or how it might change, you know, the branches, the behaviors, or your marketing?
So I think that humans don't like change. I think the Brits really don't like change. They're really bad at adopting things. And I think that we are all going to be very biased towards our own career. We're going to be very protective of our own jobs because, well, they're going to get affected, but we'll be the last people. So I'm caveating myself by saying, I think at the upper end of the market, we might be a little bit later down the chain to get affected. I'm seeing some stuff that I think could really revolutionize our industry. I had a Teams call with someone, and he had built a voice agent. And he said to me, okay, we're going to have a conversation with someone. You speak to him like he's one of your sales agents and ask him about properties that you have available in your business. So on a Teams call, I said, hi, my name's Bertie. I'm looking for a £3 million flat. And my own voice started speaking back to me. And he knew everything that was on our website. He could, you know, he said, okay, we've got quite a few properties between 3 and 4 million. I need you to be a little bit more, you know, can you define your search a bit more? So I said, well, I want 3 bedrooms and I want some outside space. Okay, we've got 5 things available. Would you like me to go through them on the phone, or can I send you an email? There's one in particular that I think you should book a viewing in for, and I see we've got availability tomorrow. I mean, it was, I think probably 20% of people that heard it would still think it's AI, but
it's crazy. Yeah.
I'm very nervous about, it's a very generic tool at the moment. And I think AI is taking like the whole world of data, and they're aggregating it to an average. And I think that quite a lot of, you know, you start seeing it on LinkedIn, there's basically everyone's using AI. So it's become, I think, a little bit bland. It's quite similar. And my concern for our business is we're trying to offer a really bespoke, really thoughtful, really high-end service. And I'm nervous about creating, it not being really, really top end. But we're a very niche business, and there are lots of businesses out there that are doing hundreds and thousands of transactions every year. And if consumers could call at 8 p.m. and speak Chinese or German or whatever and book a viewing automatically, I think that's going to hugely transform our industry.
And I think you're That example is a great one from the, and there's a lot of stuff on AI at the moment, and you can get drowned on it. But I think the best or the coolest kind of explanation that I've heard ties in with, you know, that last kind of example you gave, where I think what AI will do is really allow us as a really useful tool. It's not going to be seen as taking over the world or our jobs or anything like this. It's like, how can you leverage as a tool for good? And the example we're given was amazing, which is, you know, if you sit down to do Lego with your kids, which if you've got kids like me, you've always been, you know, at some point you will sit down and do Lego. And I absolutely hate doing Lego, unlike a lot of other people who love it. I hate it. But the whole point of doing Lego with your kids is you want to build a memory. And that memory bit is actually the very small part, because the bigger part is actually building the Lego. And then the biggest part is finding all the bloody pieces to make what you're going to build that's then going to make the memory. And it's like this pyramid. Now, what AI can do, and it's awesome. I then, you know, used it after I heard this analogy literally the next day, and it worked brilliantly, is, yeah, there's a piece of AI now that you take a photo of all the crap pieces that your kids have left in a box. You run it, and it'll say, these are all the things you can build. And not only that, here's where they all are, and here's a step by step. And so what it's doing is it's taking out that boring part of like having to find all the pieces, which no one wants to do. You want to get on to building it and making the memories. And it's just lifting up that kind of pain point and allowing you to do the useful, the value add. And I think, you know, in your analogy of, you know, where you can offer a kind of 24/7 service or like language that, you know, you couldn't, it's like, how can it help leverage and become a real, you know, efficient tool like that, or productivity?
Any questions, any other thoughts that we've missed? My head sort of exploding with exciting data.
The last stat I have for you, you have to probably think in your head, because you'll probably make you feel foolish and get it right, but out of the 1.1 million transactions a year you mentioned, think about how many were over £1 million. So out of that 1.1 million in 2024, one of you can guess in your head, like how many you think were over £1 million in the whole of the UK, this is. The whole of the UK.
So I think average house price is about £350,000.
Yeah.
So 30%?
So, I mean, it's staggering. Less than 30,000.
Less than 30,000?
30,000 properties last year in the UK were sold over £1 million. And that was an increase of over 15% from 2023. And I think that's always amazing, especially if you're in London and you think, no way. And that was always a stat I absolutely love, is it just makes you realize. So no more than 30,000 out of that 1.1 million, which, as I mentioned earlier, is usually about 1.2 million, is over £1 million pounds.
I mean, in the patches that we cover, the sort of Mayfair, Marylebone, Kensington, Notting Hill, Chelsea, Knightsbridge, Belgravia, there are on average about 500, 600 a year, which feels like a lot. And sometimes not that much, but it is quite a lot. I mean, I suppose when you know it's only 30,000 over £1 million.
Yeah. So there we go. We probably found the stats out of how many you sell within the UK of that. So we'll have to do that.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
It'd be great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bertie.